help me welcome our speaker for tonight. It's Steph from the South College Speakers Group in Delaware.
All right, Steph!
Hi, I'm Steph. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Steph.
Hi, family. I'm really nervous. There's a lot of you here. First and foremost, I have a sobriety date. It's October 3rd of 2009. My home group, as he said, is the South College Speakers Group. I know a lot of you guys have been there. For those of you who have not, we meet Wednesday nights at 8:30 in Newark, Delaware, and it is a meeting just like this one. We put up a one-hour speaker each week. We try to make sure that that person that is speaking at our podium is an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous and has done the 12 steps and has experienced something by trying to carry that into their everyday life. And I try to do that to the best of my ability. The last thing is I have a sponsor. My sponsor has a sponsor and so on and so forth. And I was taken through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, for those of you that have read the big book, there is a lot of promises in our big book. And I think one of the most profound is you can see written in our steps themselves, and it says that we will have a spiritual awakening as the result of the steps. And that's if you do them honestly and thoroughly. And I did that, and I had one of those. And the only reason I am sober today is because I had one of those, because I tried everything else, and none of it worked. So that being said, I guess I will tell you guys a little bit about what it was like for me, and that's before I started drinking, that's during my drinking, what happened, and what it's like now, because I try to practice these 12 steps in my everyday life. I guess I always usually start off when I speak by talking a little bit about my family life. A lot of speakers, I'm sure you guys have been to speaker meetings before, obviously. So a lot of speakers I hear talking about all the time that they always felt this disconnect in their life. And to be honest, my memories are either incredibly, incredibly, incredibly vivid or basically non-existent. So I don't remember too much about this uncomfortable feeling I had as a very young child. I remember that coming later. But I was born in Brazil, two parents, two very good parents that did the best they could, and we moved to Delaware when I was pretty young. And, you know, my dad was an intellectual man, and he stressed the importance of education and getting good grades, and my mom was like, I always describe her as the embodiment of love, because in my eyes, she is probably just one of the most perfect people I've ever known. You know, she taught me morals and values. You know, we went to church every Sunday, and my mom was one of those people that carried the religion into Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday and didn't just do it on Sunday. So I always had a very good example of what having a relationship with God could be like. You know, every night my mom tucked me into bed, and she would teach me how to pray. She would say my prayers with me, and that's how I was raised. You know, and I don't necessarily think that, like, I had this concept of God that I have today. I think my concept at the time is, I'll pray and you give me what I want. And I'm sure a lot of us had that concept. And, you know, that worked for me for a lot of the years of my childhood. I was an only child, very, very spoiled. My parents gave me everything I wanted. And, like, I remember life being pretty comfortable for me. And, you know, a lot of the time, even today, if I'm not practicing the principles of this program, if I'm getting everything I want, which may happen on occasion, I feel, for the most part, pretty comfortable. You know, and at that time, I was getting everything I want, and all my powers in life was the stuff I had around me. I had anything a kid could ask for, and that was what my power was, because if I had that, I was better than you, and what I've always wanted is to be better than all of you. So anyway, that's how I grew up. When I was, I guess the one thing I'll say as well is I was raised with alcohol in my household. My dad was an alcoholic, and I was drinking when I was very, very young, like 6 or 7 or 8. And I don't remember that being a problem. I don't remember my dad's alcoholism being a problem whatsoever, because at that point in his drinking, he was very happy. You know, he was getting a very good effect produced by alcohol, and that's why we drink, right? So he was getting that, and I remember the house being happy, and I remember him laughing and singing and, like, dancing, and, like, I'm 6 years old, and I'm drinking with my dad. And the reason I always share that is not because, like, I was a hopeless alcoholic at the age of 6 or 7 or 8 years old, because I wasn't. But the reason I share that is because alcohol was part of my family. Alcohol had always been in my life, and my perception was that alcohol would always be in my life. The thought of not having it be there never crossed my mind, not once, even when I did enter the rooms of AA. excuse me. So when I was about 11 years old, this picture-perfect life that I had changed. And the way that it changed is my dad lost his very good-paying job, so I couldn't have all my stuff anymore. And that doesn't make any child very happy, let alone a child that may be suffering with alcoholism. So, you know, I was not happy. And that same year, this mother was my rock, she had had no history of it before, but she developed schizophrenia. You know, so it was like, it was crazy. Like, if my mom wasn't trying to kill herself, she was, like, trying to kill me and my dad. And it's not funny, but I find it funny. So, I'm sorry. Thank you, Kendall. So, anyway, that's what life became. Drinking all the time and, like, two parents who were just out of their mind crazy. And, like, I would have told you for the longest time that's why I turned out the way that I did. That's why I turned into this, like, messed up, depraved, just disgusting, junky alcoholic. And the fact of the matter is I could see why people would use that as an excuse. We've all used excuses like that. But the fact of the matter is I was drinking before those things ever happened. You know what I mean? I was drinking when I was a kid and before any of those traumatic things had ever happened to me, so I can't use that as an excuse anymore. but my drinking did really take off at that point. And, you know, I really turned into, like, this, like, sort of obnoxious, like, you know, the typical, like, really angsty teenager that, like, dyes their hair, like, weird colors and, like, wears black all the time, and I still do that. But, you know, like, I would run around the school and I would, like, carve anarchy symbols into the lockers and just, like, do anything I could to let you guys know that I was really, really pissed off, you know? And I wanted to make that known. And I wanted everybody to know that I thought it was your fault. And that was my goal. And, you know, pouring a whole lot of whiskey on top of that behavior and just doing really, really stupid things every day of my life. And obviously when you are a kid, when you're 11, 12 years old and you're engaging in these sorts of behaviors, people notice, you know. So then came the therapists and the counselors and the psychiatrists. And, you know, I was diagnosed with all sorts of fun illnesses. Like, I'm sure a lot of you have heard it. Like, I don't know if any of you are bipolar and you know, like, personality disorder and all this ridiculous stuff. But that's what untreated alcoholism looks like, you know. And a lot of very well-intentioned people were doing everything they could to help this really messed up kid. And the fact of the matter is that what alcohol was doing for me at this point in my life is I was like this ball of anger. I was this ball of resentment, and I hated everybody. You know, and like when I would drink, I was like in this cage of like, I can't see through this cage, through all this anger and through all this pain. But when you drink, suddenly it's like the key to the cage and you can walk out and you can just be a part of the world with everybody else. And that's all I wanted, was to be a part of the world, because I felt that I was so different than you. And I just wanted to be with you. And I couldn't have told you that then. I wanted you to think that I didn't need you and that I didn't like you and that I hated you. But the fact of the matter is the reason I did that is because I was going to hate you before you had the opportunity to hate me, because at this point in my life I thought I was the most disgusting person in the world, and why would anybody want anything to do with me? So I'm going to get a sip of water. Sorry. So anyway, I was in school around like the age of like 13, 14. I'm in and out of the psych ward. I think like through high school, I was in this psych ward, Rockford Center that we have in Delaware. I was in there 11 times. People are trying to help me and help me and help me. And, you know, the only thing I wanted was the relief I was getting from alcohol. So as soon as I exited the psych ward, I would pick up, you know, the bottle of prescription pills that my doctor gave me, and I would get some of my dad's whiskey, and I would just drink it away, and I wouldn't feel it, and I was very comfortable like that. And that's how I wanted to live. That's how I wanted to spend every single day of my life. but what ended up happening is I took a little bit too much of the medicine, and I drank a little bit too much whiskey, and I flatlined, apparently, and, like, almost died, and I woke up in this hospital. And like my parents, who, despite their circumstances, were still trying to help me. And, you know, they're sitting there like, what are we going to do with this kid? And, they ended up, my mom, who was this wonderful Christian woman, thought God could help me. And she thought, right, unfortunately, it just wasn't the time that I was going to, be willing to hear, anything about God. So she sent me to this Christian-based rehab, and, you know, I don't remember much of that experience. I was pretty young, and I was pretty angry, and I looked a disaster, and one of the only memories I have from that experience is something that has come back to me since I've gotten sober, and I remember I was sitting across a table or desk from a pastor, and this pastor was basically asking me, like, Steph, like, why do you feel the need to do this? You know, like, obviously there's something wrong. You're being stupid. Like, why do you feel the need to do this? And my only answer for him, the only excuse I can give, the only trigger I have, my answer was life. Like, the fact that I wake up in the morning, the fact that I'm alive and breathing, my heart is pumping, that is reason enough for me to drink. That is reason enough for me to do the way that I do. Because the way that I see it is I look out at the rest of the world, and I look at you, and I think, you guys just have this pat. Like, you guys just know how to walk around out there. You guys know how to get jobs. You guys know how to go to school. You know how to talk to people, look people in the eye, be friendly. I didn't know how to do any of that stuff. And alcohol taught me how to do that. Alcohol gave me inspiration. You know what I mean? So the fact that I'm alive is reason enough for me to drink. And that's all that I need. So I don't remember what he said in reply, but anyway. If anybody has that idea, if anybody has ever felt that you have to drink simply because you woke up this morning, then talk to somebody in this meeting, because lots of us have been there. And the beautiful thing is we have found a way to not live that way. And I had to be taught that. It's not something I just know how to do innately. So anyway, when I got out of this rehab, I guess that experience sort of scared me a bit. Like, I wasn't yet at the point where I wanted to die. And I did get to that point, but at that point I was not there yet. All I wanted to do was sort of just have fun. Like any kid would want to do when they're 16 years old. You know what I mean? That's normal. It was totally normal for me. I didn't see anything wrong with that behavior. So I get out. I end up graduating high school, sort of. I did, like, correspondence classes because they were like, I don't know if you really want to come back here, Steph. You're a little bit messed up. But anyway, they let me graduate. I get this job. And I was working at this little coffee shop, and, like, I used to describe this as my period of controlled drinking, because that's what I really thought that it was at the time. Because at the time, you know, I had been, you know, physically addicted to some other substances, and I would drink on top of those things. And when I ended up getting this job, I was like, okay, I'll just drink. You know what I mean? I don't necessarily need to go back to these other things, and I'll just drink. And I always describe that as my period of control. Maybe smoke a little bit of pot, too. But, you know, the fact of the matter was, is every time that I drank, I would black out. And, like, only an alcoholic would see that as controlled drinking. I don't think normal people, you know, are like, let's do a blackout tonight. But that's sort of my goal. Like, I love that. It's fun. And you know, I was just pretty much drinking at this point in my life. And at this point, I had lost, like, a lot of friends. Nobody wanted to be around me. I was very miserable. You know, I was always trying to fight somebody, and fight somebody for really stupid reasons, for reasons that I'm guilty of. Like, I think we were talking about this on the ride up, is, like, I would always hate people that were, like, very, like, angsty and, like, oh, my God, like, my life is so hard. And then every night, like, I would, like, go home and, like, this is awful. Like, why am I alive? And I would drink by myself in my room and just be very pathetic. And, you know, that's who I was. And it was sort of... It wasn't as fun anymore, but it was still just enough fun that I wasn't willing to change the behavior. And what ended up happening is I was working at this job, and, like, I was working at this coffee shop, and, like, the front of this coffee shop faced the back of this diner. And, like, I know, like, a lot of you guys have probably worked in diners in your addiction, and, you know, like, it's, like, a whole bunch of crackheads and stuff. So I was like, my people, like, they're here for me. And so... I'm watching all these people and, like, coming out, like, smoking stuff they shouldn't be smoking and drinking when they shouldn't be drinking. And, you know, I always say this because it's very true. My, like, favorite quality in a man is that he's a junkie. I am very drawn to that, you know, and he's very attractive to me. And so I see this, like, pale... like, emaciated, like, looks like any minute you're going to find him in the parking lot with a needle in his jugular vein looking guy. And I was like, he will be the one, you know? And so I made him the one. And like, it's funny because I know a lot of alcoholic women think that way. We're just very drawn to, like, the sickest men. And I'm sure that there's a lot of men that are very drawn to very sick women. But, like, it is funny to me today. And, like, I look at people in the program who engage in those sorts of things. And the fact of the matter is, like, I can't really say much because I'm still with him today. And which is kind of funny, but it's very odd. I had an absolute blast with him. And, you know, we were running around doing stupid stuff. I found someone who was exactly like me, who wanted to drink like me, who wanted to do the other things that I liked to do. And I felt like I had found a companion other than the companion that I had in the bottle. And that was what I wanted. Like, I've always wanted relationships with people and never knew how to do it. So I found one, right? I found one in this junkie. And like, the thing that is crazy about it is that, like, I used to consider this to be probably the worst thing that ever happened, is that one day he did something stupid and was told he had to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was like, no, that's not going to work. How are we going to fit this into you being sober? And I wasn't pleased with that. You know, and then I had all these people around me telling me, like, Steph, you're just like him. You go to AA. And then I'm like, no, that's not going to work either, you know. But, like, at this point in my life, I had gotten kicked out of my parents' house. Like, I didn't have any friends aside from the boyfriend. And, you know, so... basically, the way that I saw it was my only option is going to AA. You know, so I went very begrudgingly. And, you know, like, I was introduced to my home group today, the South College Speakers Group, and that meeting, like, scared me to death. Like, you walk in there. It's like how you guys are here. Like, you walk in, people are like, hi, how are you? Nice to see you. Like, they're so excited. They're smiling. You can see their teeth. Like, I'm not attracted to that behavior, you know what I mean? And that's like, whoa, like, what's wrong with you? And And that really put me off. You know, people are always trying to talk to me. They're trying to introduce me to people. I'm like, get away from me. Like, what is wrong with you? Why would you want to talk to me? And frankly, I don't want to talk to you either. And, you know, so like what I did is I got this sobriety date. And, you know, I sobriety date. And I stuck with that for a while, even though it wasn't necessarily true. I would go to meetings, and people would, like, scare the shit out of me with their, like, friendly hellos. So I would be like, all right, I'm just going to go to the car. So, like, I'd go to the car, and, you know, I would do fun stuff at the time. And, you know, at this point, I was living with this boyfriend who was sober and Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, the difference between him and I is that when he came into AA, he did the steps. He got a sponsor. He had an experience. He wanted sobriety. You know what I mean? And, you know, so he's trying to live this way of life, and I'm over here living like a scumbag, living like a liar, living the only way I've ever known how to live, basically. And I got caught. You know what I mean? Obviously. And, you know, so many people wanted so desperately to help me because I was drowning. And at that point, I couldn't have told you I was drowning. I didn't know I was drowning. But I was, and people around me saw it, and, you know, they wanted to help me, and I remember, like, people sitting me down, like, they actually had me listen to this CD, A History on the Alcoholics Anonymous by Steve F., and I'm sure a lot of you guys have heard that talk, and it's wonderful, and I've listened to it since, but they had me listen to this, and basically this talk was all about singleness of purpose. A primary purpose, and how we need to be here to help one another and to love one another. And, you know, a really beautiful message, but it really stressed that we need to have a sponsor guide us through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous if we are to have a spiritual experience, if we are to stay sober. You know what I mean? And that's what this talk was about. So I listened to the whole thing, and then I'm like, okay, that sounds good. Like, all right, sobriety can be all right. I think I'll give it a shot, but, like, I don't need a sponsor. I think I'll just do that by myself. And I'm sure a lot of you in this room have tried that approach. That didn't work for me. I think I stayed sober after that, like, 7 hours or so. And, you know, and for the next 3 years, that's how I lived. You know, I heard this speaker talk about it once, and I really feel it's the most beautiful way to describe it, simple and beautiful. It's the most horrible place to be when an alcoholic can't get drunk and can't get sober. And that's where what happened in that three-year time period. You know, drinking and doing the other things that accompany our drinking were still a lot of fun for me, and I was still getting that magical effect produced by alcohol. And then slowly but surely, it started to hurt. You know, I have always paid consequences for my drinking. Since I was probably like 11, 10 years old, I've paid consequences for the way that I like to drink. Consequences did not mean a thing to me, because the effect that alcohol gave me always outweighed whatever consequence there was. And what happened is consequences kept coming, and suddenly alcohol wasn't making that pain go away. And alcohol had always given me the ability to not feel that pain, and suddenly I would drink and I would still feel it. And I would drink and I would still feel tired. And I would drink and I would still feel anxious, and I would drink and I would still hate you, and I would drink and I wanted to die, you know, and that's very foreign to me because alcohol had been my God, and alcohol had been everything to me, and it, like, turned its back on me. It wasn't my friend anymore, you know what I mean? It wasn't giving me comfort anymore, and that is the scariest thing in the entire world. That is the most pain I've ever felt up until recently. And I'll tell you about that. And, you know, so what do you do? in that spot. I tried everything. You know, I had stuff on the outside. You know, you hear so many people talking about, like, how they lost everything. I didn't lose everything material. When I came into AA this time, I was still with my boyfriend. When I came into AA this time, I had an apartment. I had a job that I wasn't a very good employee of, though. And, you know, I had a car. Like, I had things. But I was dying. And every day I would wake up and I would wish I were dead. And that's not anything unique in these rooms. I think a lot of us have had that experience. But, like, what was going on in my head is, okay, like, all right, my mom had schizophrenia. Like, I am schizophrenic. Like, that's the problem. And like, I was convinced that, like, I was insane and that I was schizophrenic and, like, I needed to be locked up. I needed to be put away. And, like, I had no idea what to do. I didn't have any friends. I had a horrible relationship with the only two family members I had, which were my mom and my dad. You know, and the only thing I could think of is, like, ooh, I have a boyfriend in AA. Like, I'm not recommending that sort of relationship for anyone, by the way. That was really bad. And I am very sorry for what I put him through. But I knew that at one point this guy had thought the way that I did. And I knew at some point this guy had been just as miserable as I now was. I didn't necessarily think he was crazy the way I thought I was crazy, but, you know, to me, the only option was ask him, like, what do I do now? So I asked him, and, you know, I told him the truth, which I rarely did. I rarely ever told the truth. But I told him what was going on in this ridiculous, messed up head of mine, and he told me to pray. And I don't know if anybody has ever been new in the program and somebody told you to pray. And you're just like, really? Is that all you got for me? Like, I don't think that's going to work. And, but, like, thank God that, like, I didn't have any other ideas. Like, I had no idea what direction to go. You know what I mean? And I didn't believe that it would work. But I was just like, what else am I going to do? You know what I mean? So I prayed. And I prayed and I prayed for about a month. And I prayed the way he told me to, which was to ask what God's will was for me and to try to carry that out. And I did that, like I said, for about a month. And I kept drinking. And I was drinking and I was drinking and I was drinking. And I was dying. And but I kept saying this prayer. And, you know, today, the way that I see it, is that those first three steps are in line for us when we come into the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, you're either going to know you're powerless or you're not. You're either going to concede that your life is unmanageable or you're not. You know what I mean? If you show up here, it's probably because you think that there is a power here that can help you. You know what I mean? And you're either going to turn your life over to that power or you're not. And my experience was that those first three steps for me were in line before I ever walked through these doors. And I would have sworn that I never would come back to AA. But I ended up back in AA. And to this day, I can't tell you the sequence of events that happened because I don't remember. But I ended up back in AA. And I wasn't happy to be there, but I was sober, and I don't know exactly how long I had sober, but it was probably a couple weeks, and it was like a miserable couple of weeks that I had, and like, I remember we drove to this meeting in Lewis Beach, Delaware, and it was a speaker meeting as well, and I remember being absolutely petrified, like, I was shaking. I was so scared. Because I don't know how to talk to you. Like, I don't know how to look at you. What do I say to you? You know what I mean? Like, alcohol wasn't telling me how to do that, and I had no idea what to do. So what I do is I hide in a corner. You know, so I hide in a corner, and I glare so that you'll know, like, keep back. I will hurt you with my pain. And so I'm in this meeting, and, like I said, like, I absolutely believed that people in Alcoholics Anonymous drank the way I drank, used drugs the way that I used drugs. Like, I believed that. But what I didn't understand is that there was more to it than that. I didn't think you guys had all the crazy going on that I had. Like, I thought that was what separated me from you. You know, and I'm sitting in this meeting, and I hear this speaker talk, and it's funny because he's a friend of mine today. And I'm like, really, you? But I heard this message from this guy, and, like, he was talking about how, like, life was painful. And for a while, alcohol would remove that, and then alcohol stopped removing that. And, like, I'm sure he said it much more eloquently than that, but I heard it. And, like, for the first time in my life, like, I trusted somebody in AA. I trusted that they had the same thing that I had. And it didn't give me hope. I won't say it gave me hope because I didn't hear him talk about a solution. And I'm positive that he did, but I didn't hear that because I wasn't able to. And, you know, but I did trust him, and I did believe that he was like me. You know, that doesn't make me ask for help, though. You know what I mean? I have a whole bunch of pride. So instead, I walked out of the meeting, and, like, I stood, like, somewhere over there, and, like, I was like this. And, like, I see this girl approaching, and she's shorter than me, which is a feat, you know what I mean? And she's so cute, and she's adorable, and she smiles at me, and I'm like, oh, God, like, what are you doing? Don't come over here. Don't come over here. And she comes over there. And thank God. Thank God recovered alcoholics do not wait for the sick and suffering to ask for help. Because I would not have. And, like, I honestly, in my heart, know that I would have killed myself. I had the courage to kill myself before I had the courage to walk up to you and to tell me how you changed. You know what I mean? So she didn't wait for me. And, you know, she let me, like, spill my guts, which, like I said, I was such a liar. And it was the first time I was ever honest with a woman who was trying to help me, to try to be of service to me. And she offered me a solution. And to be honest, like I said, I didn't believe it was for me. I didn't necessarily believe that it would work for me. But if God does one thing, it is use our character defects to his benefit, because I was so consumed by fear that I was afraid to tell her no. And I was afraid to not do what she told me to do because, I don't know, like I have absolutely no life skills without the bottle in me. And, you know, so I did what she told me to do. When she told me to pray, I prayed. When she told me to write, I wrote. When she told me to confess my harm's done, I confessed my harm's done. You know what I mean? And what ended up happening is I had an incredible, profound experience with the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went through those steps the first time with my sponsor in a week and a half. And I'm not necessarily saying that everybody has to do it that way. I'm saying that that was my experience. And my experience is that in that week and a half, I felt the results. And don't get me wrong, like, I was still, like, batshit crazy. And, but, like, something changed. And, like, when I was going through an inventory with my sponsor, for the first time, I saw who I was. And I didn't like it. And I didn't want it. You know what I mean? And that carried me into our sixth and seventh step. Like, I desperately wanted to be different. I desperately wanted to change. I did not like who I was. And whatever else she told me to do, I did. I had some incredible experiences. Is that the right word? I'm sorry. But experiences with amends. With amends that I didn't even want to do, but I did because she told me to do them. And life got different. And, like, suddenly life wasn't uncomfortable anymore. Like, suddenly, like, rather than looking down at the cement or glaring, I could look you in the eye. I could smile. You know what I mean? I didn't know how to do any of that stuff. Like, I knew how to be angry. And I developed a love for Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I'm like a month sober, and I'm like running around like, I'll be your sponsor, I'll be your sponsor. And like throwing the big book at people, like smashing them over the head with it. I didn't actually do that. I just wanted to do that. You know, but like, it was probably one of the happiest times in my life. And like, I've tried to do that consistently ever since. And, I am a firm believer, as I know others are in this room, that if I was not able to experience happy sobriety, there is no way I would have stayed here. Absolutely not. Like, if I'm going to be miserable, I can be miserable with whiskey in my belly. You know what I mean? Like, that's what I know how to do. And thank God people took time out of their lives to show me how to live differently. And like I said, I tried to carry on with that. And, you know, I was really in this delusion that life would stay that way and that I would just stay in this happy little bubble. And what happened is life happened. And I failed to mention, before I even got sober, my dad was diagnosed with colon cancer. And I was still drinking at the time. When he told me, I was like, all right, see you later. And like, I disappeared. Like, horrible damage done. Like, hurt that man immensely, you know. I would steal his pain meds because a junkie needs it more than a cancer patient. You know, and like, that's who I was. And, you know, what I was taught to do, what women in this program taught me how to do, is to take my dad to doctor's appointments, is to pick up his meds and not steal them from the pharmacy. You know what I mean? I was taught how to be of service to him. And I did all that stuff. And it was still, like, there was still a little bit, like, of uncomfortable stuff going on. And then I had a woman in AA tell me, like, because I still didn't know how to talk to him. I didn't know how to form a relationship with him. I had a woman in AA tell me, Steph, do you ever ask your dad how he's doing? And I was like, what? Like, I didn't know how to do that. I don't know how to ask you how you're doing. You know, so she told me to do that, and I did. And, like, he did not ever get sober, my father. He was a pretty miserable guy. And, like, at first I was very afraid to ask those questions because I was afraid of his answers, like, frankly. And to be honest, like, it was very difficult to hear him go on about, like, how bad it is and stuff. But I sat there and I listened, and I listened quietly. And I kept doing that. And I had another woman in Alcoholics Anonymous suggest to me, Steph, do you ever tell your dad that you love him? And I was like, no, I haven't said that since I was, what, maybe like 5 years old. And, you know, so she told me to. I was so afraid to do that, you know. I did love him. I don't know how to say those words, though. I'm not good with those words. But I did it. And I was so pissed because when I said it, he didn't say anything back. And I'm like, how dare you? Like, you love me. I'm your child. Say it. And I was like, I'm never doing that again. And but I did it again because somebody told me to do it again. And I kept doing it until the day came when my dad would say it before I had the opportunity to say it. And that is God, because that's not who I am. Like, I am such a miserable bitch. Like, I am awful to people. I am grimy. I am a thief. You know what I mean? Like, I will step on you to get what I want. I will manipulate you to get what I want. God changed me. And he changed that relationship with my father. You know, my dad died. He was taking his last breath on my year anniversary. And like, I didn't make that about me because people told me not to make that about me. Like, my dad got to die with me holding his hand, which is not something that I would have ever expected. And My mom was very sick at this time, and you know, I was an only child. Like I said, my family all lived in Brazil, and I did not have the means by which to take care of her. So before my father had passed away, we had determined that it would be a good idea for my mom to move back to Brazil with her family. And so I took her to Brazil, and I stayed there for 6 weeks with her. And when I left, she wasn't well. A couple weeks when I got back to the United States, I got a call that she was in the hospital. When... Does anybody have a tissue? Thank you. When I went back to Brazil, my mother died 6 months after my dad. And here's the thing about that is after my dad died, I did what the people in Alcoholics Anonymous told me to do, and that was to be of service to my mother and to be of service to the alcoholics suffering in this room. And I did that. Now, the circumstances surrounding my mom's death, some people did some pretty nasty things. And I was very upset with those people. Very, very upset with those people. And, you know, I would have liked to have told myself that my resentments are justified. And I'm sure that there are people outside of the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous who would have told me that those resentments were justified. But the fact of the matter is the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous tells me that I do not have that luxury. And I don't care what people have done. I cannot stay resentful or I will die. And what happened was, is after my mom died, I decided to hate them. And when Alcoholics Anonymous teaches you how to love and teaches you how to be of service, you can't just take that back and keep your happy sobriety, you know. But I took it back. And one of the incredible things that happened to me when I was first going through the 12 steps is the obsession to drink was lifted. And I was not fighting that. Now, when I decided to embrace that hatred, when I decided to take that back and nurture that and tell myself that I deserve to feel that way, it took about 2 days before I was gripping the seat of the car because I could not stand sobriety anymore. And God has plans, man, and God does do for us what we cannot do for ourselves, because to be honest, looking back at that point in my life, it was not my choice to carry on living. My choice was to go get a bottle, to go get a bag, and to end it. You know what I mean? But God makes things happen, and I can't explain that. And at this point in my life, I didn't have a car. My car had broken down. My boyfriend was in school, so his car was gone. I remember begging him to drive me to get what I needed. He would not do it. I said, I'll go into the house and I'll drink the Listerine, like whatever. He went, he dumped it out. You know what I mean? Some people might say that an alcoholic needed that pain, and that if an alcoholic wanted to go back out, then they were going to go back out. But I'm glad that he did what he did, because he saved my life. Because it wasn't my intention to just drink. My intention was to go die. And, you know, I obsessively tried to get a hold of what I needed for about 2 days, and I couldn't find a way out of my house. I called everybody that I used to know, and nobody would come and help me get out of my house. And a few days later, my boyfriend drove me to my sponsor's house, and I went into her house. She sat me at the table. She put a notebook in front of me. She put a pen in my hand. And what she told me to do was write an inventory. And she had been telling me that for a few days, but I was like, how is that going to help this situation? And how stupid I am, because that is what saved my life the first time around. That is what saved my life the first time around, and how quickly I forget. And all I wanted to do was to write this inventory so I could say, see, it didn't work, and then my boyfriend would go drive me to get what I needed, or I was in walking distance from her house to go get what I needed. And so I just wrote the stupid inventory, right? And God works, right? Because writing that did not take away the pain of losing my parents. That is pain that I still go through today. But it did take the obsession away again. As she promised me it would, as I called her a liar, like I did the first time around. You know what I mean? The 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous work. And they have saved me more than once. So I tried to practice again. And like I said, I was in a lot of pain. But I kept practicing again. And I would go to meetings, and I would try to be of service. I would do what people told me to do. I would put my hand out to those who suffer. And I remember people saying to me, Steph, one day this is going to be an experience that you can use to benefit somebody else. And I'm like, psh, okay. Right? My sponsor said those words to me. And in September, someone who had been in the program, actually my sponsor's cousin, killed herself as a direct result of untreated alcoholism. And it's funny that I had told my sponsor that I would never be able to use this experience to benefit somebody else. And then I found her in the midst of the same pain that I had just gone through. And because of my experience didn't lessen her pain. Of course it didn't. But my experience did teach me what it was to be a friend and what it was to serve and to just try to hold somebody's hand and love them when that is all that they need from you. And it has given me a bond with her that I'm so grateful for today. You guys in this room, the only family that I ever known, my parents, they're gone now. And you guys have become my family. You guys have become my best friends. You guys have saved my life. I'm very emotional, I'm sorry. This program works. And if there's anybody in this room who is in excruciating pain and is too afraid to live and too afraid to die and is too afraid to drink and too afraid to not drink, then do what I did and go stand awkwardly in the corner until one of us finds you. And then do what I did and be afraid to say no when a sponsor tells you what to do in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I guarantee you that you will have a profound experience, an experience that will keep you sober as long as you keep seeking it. I'm so grateful for this program. And I want to thank Dave for having me out to speak tonight. And I want to thank all of you for being here. And that's all I have to share. Thanks. Thank you.